Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, yesterday the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, said he's contacting opposition spokespeople to discuss bringing in exclusion areas to prevent peaceful protests or events outside hospitals and GP surgeries where abortions will be facilitated. Of course, this comes as a regulation of Termination of Pregnancy Act passed in December, and indeed a story that is covered in the newspapers today. It's a picture of a group of people peacefully protesting outside of Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, where the first abortion was believed to have taken place yesterday morning. So what are these safe access zones likely to look like, and does it conflict with our right to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech? On the line to give us his thoughts is John McGurk, who is the former campaign director for the Save the Eighth campaign. John, good morning.
Good morning, Wendy. Happy New Year. How are you?
So Minister for Health Simon Harris, when responding to, I believe there was a Facebook post online basically asking for people's prayers in relation to this abortion that was believed to have taken place yesterday in Our Lady of Lourdes and Drogheda, and then a picture of a group of people outside Our Lady of Lourdes taking part in what looks like a fairly peaceful protest. He said it was extraordinarily unedifying. What do you make of his comments?
Well, I think the first thing to recognise is that when we live in a democracy, we're not always going to agree with each other. And I certainly don't agree with Simon Harris that the protest was unedifying. What I will say, though, is that occasionally when you live in a democracy, you're going to find things unedifying that other people do. I find a lot of what the Minister for Health says and how he conducts himself deeply unedifying, but he has a right to do it. And I think, you know, what he's essentially proposing to do here with his law restricting access to protest space is to basically ban one person's free speech to protect the feelings of another. That's what he's proposing to do. It's basically a law against hurt feelings. And that's a terrible, terrible road for us to go down, because there's no guiding principle. There's no obvious line you can draw and say, well, this is a clear principled reason for banning free speech.
Well, I suppose his argument would be it's not about hurt feelings, it's about not intimidating women who are kind of walking in to undergo a surgical abortion, for example, in a hospital, that the fear would be, will these women be harassed and intimidated? And that's not
right. Well, the thing is, we already have laws against harassment and intimidation. They're on the statute books already, and they should be enforced. And I don't, I don't know the individuals who were protesting yesterday. I don't know all of the individuals who were protesting over the weekend at a different location. But one thing those people were not doing was harassing or intimidating anybody. And I think one of the things that we see increasingly happening in our society, Wendy, is legitimate opposition being denounced as hate-filled or harassment. And those two things are very different. And it's very dangerous to go down that road to say somebody who peacefully disagrees with me, their mere presence is harassment or intimidation, because that's the argument that's being made. The argument that's being made is simply by standing there expressing yourself peacefully, although you may not intend to intimidate somebody, your presence is intimidating and therefore it should be banned. That's the argument that's being made, and it does come back to protecting people's feelings. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves, Wendy, is where do you draw that line? I mean, where do you draw it? Because I said over the weekend, and you know, no one has really been able to provide an answer to me on this point, is why, therefore, would we not also extend a protest exclusion zone around supermarkets or the Israeli embassy? If you're going tomorrow to buy your sausages and your rashers, I don't know if you eat meat, but if you do, for, you know, Wednesday, Thursday morning's breakfast, and there are a bunch of people standing outside, you know, saying pigs are slaughtered in terrible, terrible ways, they die screaming. That might upset you. It might upset you deeply as a meat eater. It might upset vegetarians who are going in there with no intention of buying meat. Do those people have a right to protest the supermarket? I think they do. And I don't think the fact that you're upset by them means that they should be moved on by law. Equally, if you were going to the Israeli embassy on Thursday to get a visa to go to Jerusalem, and you walked past, you know, 50 socialists shouting hate and death to the state of Israel every time you walked in there, I think you might be a little bit intimidated, and you should, you know, perhaps those people should be moved on as well. So I don't know where you draw the line, because the right to freedom of speech and to make your views known extends to a whole range of situations, not just this one specific area where Simon Harris wants to intervene for political reasons.
So is it something that you think the balance is already there with the current legislation that's on the statute books in terms of, you know, harassment is not allowed? But as they're interesting examples. I mean, if there was lots of people talking about veganuary this month, I've seen vegan ads on the sides of buses and things like that. Difference between somebody standing outside a butcher, as you say, or, you know, grabbing your meat off you and throwing it on the ground or whatever. They're two very different things. One of the concerns that's been expressed in relation to you know, these peaceful protests taking place, and indeed that social media post that was just, it didn't mention obviously any individual, there was no picture, was just saying this is believed to be happening in this hospital, pray that the lady has a change of heart, I believe the post said something along those lines. So Dr. Peter Boylan yesterday was talking about basically fears around patient confidentiality. Do you think there's a conflict there, and is that one of the reasons that might be justifying these safe zones?
I think that's absurd. I mean, I can tell your listeners today exclusively on air, Wendy, that there is there's an appendix removal taking place in Tala Hospital this afternoon. Now, if you think I've just breached patient confidentiality, I mean, if you can find the individual that's having his appendix removed or know anything about him or her, you know, fair play to you. But, I mean, that's essentially what was said here. A particular procedure is occurring in a particular area where one might expect that procedure to occur. The idea that any individual patient's confidentiality was breached by those who shared that is absurd, and it's just nonsense. And as to the idea, I mean, this idea that you can't protest outside hospitals or outside surgeries where something is taking place, I mean, you do it. It's done all the time in other examples. So let me use an example of the death penalty in the United States, where somebody is being executed. You know, it's a very sensitive moment, oftentimes for a victim's family or for the person who's being executed, their family. Nobody says you can't protest against the death penalty outside the prison where that is taking place. In fact, it happens on every single occasion. It doesn't interfere with the working of the law. It doesn't prevent what's sadly going to happen happening, but it does make a point, and it draws international attention to it in relation to that example. If you were to be protesting, for example, the poor treatment of elderly people in a nursing home, one might expect you to protest outside that nursing home rather than at a safe location 500 yards away. So long as you're not intimidating anyone or preventing people from going about their lawful business, you should be free to exercise your freedom of speech and draw attention to it. It is absurd to suggest that people should be forced to stand a kilometre away and hold up signs saying a terrible thing is happening 500 metres away from here.
Paul Cullen describes the legislation and basically just the rush to have it implemented by the 1st of January as political box ticking. Do you think the discussion around these safe access zones falls into the same category, that it's just going to happen anyway because it's deemed as politically correct and what's kind of popularly acceptable?
Well, you have to remember that, the political parties, the major ones and the minor ones, are all basically terrified of what I call the NGO lobby, your National Women's Council, your Amnesty Ireland, your Irish Council for Civil Liberties, ironically named, and all the rest of them. And you know, they wanted this very, very badly, and therefore it will happen. I have no doubt that legislation banning protests will be passed through the law. The more interesting question is whether that legislation stands up to scrutiny, not just at Irish constitutional level, but under European law, because a very similar proposed law, I recall, was struck down in relation to Austria not that long ago. So I've no doubt that the law will be passed. Whether it will stand up in the long term is another question. It certainly shouldn't. It's an appalling infringement on people's right to civilly protest. And this kind of thing was never suggested for years and years and years when people were protesting wars and occupations and standing outside embassies and all the rest of it, or standing outside the Dáil. And you know, because it's something that until now we have always naturally accepted as a right people have in our democracy. And the idea that it is quietly going to be taken away with the support, let us admit, of a large section of the population is something that should worry us terribly.
John McGurk, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's John McGurk, who was the former campaign director there for the Save the Eighth campaign. Ganza is an ancient city with a history spanning 4,000 years, and today it is a self-governing Palestinian territory whose government is dominated by Hamas, an organisation that's hostile towards Israel and regarded by several countries as a terrorist organisation. Gaza has been subject to an ongoing blockade since 2007, maintained by its neighbours Israel and Egypt. The small Christian community in Gaza faces many challenges, political, economic and social, and indeed a feeling of isolation in the knowledge that most of the world doesn't even know that they exist. I'm delighted to have on the line a man who served as a Christian pastor in Gaza for 12 years at Gaza Baptist Church and is the author of a new book called Pastor from Gaza. On the line we have Pastor Hannah Massad. Pastor Massad, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, tell us a little
bit.
Good
to be with you.
It's good to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and then the time that you spent in Gaza.
I born and grew up in Gaza most of my life. My parents belong to the Greek Orthodox Church. I got to know the Lord in personal way through the only evangelical church in Gaza, Gaza Strip. And I have the privilege to be the first local pastor for that church, and I did that from 87 to 91. Went to Bethlehem Bible College, and then in 91, the Lord opened door for me to go to the seminary in the States. But in 1999, the Lord put in my heart to go back. So I went back and pastored the same church until 2008, and we went through persecution, ended up in the West Bank for a little bit, and then in Jordan as well. But my heart is still in Gaza, and I go at least three times a year to minister in Gaza and in Jordan.
So tell us a little bit about what it was like being a pastor in Gaza. What is life like for Christians who live there?
We live between two fires. We have the fire of the militant Muslims in one hand, but also we have the fire of the Israeli occupation in the other hand. And the biggest challenge is how to live your faith and how to keep the peace and the love in these difficult circumstances. It's very challenging to be a pastor when you are the only pastor in the whole Gaza Strip. And I remember a number of times where our church building caught in fires, and when you're not able to finish your sermon because there's a fight close by. Coming, for example, sometimes Sunday morning for the service, but you're not able to get inside the building because the inside ceiling collapsed completely because of the bombing the night before. At least that Sunday you have to change your sermon as a pastor just to encourage people in these difficult circumstances. So this is really challenges you live in the daily basis.
In terms of the number of Christians that are currently living in Gaza, do we know how many there are, Pastor Massad?
No, there's about 1,000 individuals, about 350 families, and there is a Greek Orthodox Church in Gaza, and there is one Latin church, and there is only one evangelical church.
So it's a very small community. Is it a close-knit community?
Yeah, it is a close community, and the evangelical would be, this is number 1,000 out of 2 million. So, and evangelical would be minority of a minority. It's a close community, and usually also they feel isolated from the rest of the world because, you know, Gaza is, you know, under siege from every side, the land, the sea, and even the sky. So it's like a big prison for everyone over there.
What about relationships then with the government and with your Muslim neighbors?
Well, you know, when we grow up, we have a good relationship. But in the same time, as a Christian, we always felt we are second-class citizens. We're not able to live our faith freely and completely, and especially if you want to share your faith or do evangelism, that would be very risky and very dangerous.
In terms of just, I suppose, the type of life that you describe in Gaza, how does that impact your faith and challenge your faith?
You know, because we went through persecution in Gaza, and the place, in one place of our ministry been bombed by militants a couple of times, and then one of our church members been kidnapped by militants, and after 10 hours been executed because he refused to be converted, because he refused to deny his faith in Christ and to be converted to another faith. And that was very difficult. And Rami Ayad, who has been murdered by militants, Muslim in Gaza, left a widow and two children, and his wife was pregnant, so it was a difficult time. So I will say the most precious lessons we learned, it was in the time of persecution. And when you go through that that kind of fire, the fire of persecution, you experience the Lord more intimate and more in personal way.
It's an incredible testimony, and to really just think about faith in that way. Thank you for sharing that, Pastor Mazad. What about young people in Gaza? Is there many opportunities for them?
Unfortunately, the siege is affecting everybody, especially the young people. The unemployment in Gaza more than 40%, and among the young people, it's almost 65%. And the Christian young people, the unemployment even almost 80%. So as you can see, there's a lot of hopelessness, and this is one of the most difficult things for the people in Gaza, including the Christian, that there's not much hope because of the challenges, the difficulties, the political, the violence, the infrastructure, you know, the electricity, the water. 95% of the water in Gaza, it's not good for drinking. So all of these things just put more pressure on the people, especially the young people. So unfortunately, there's not much going on for them.
What is your hopes for the Christian community in Gaza?
You know, the people really in Gaza and the Christian, like any other families around the world, they just want to raise their children. They want to have a family, and they want to live in peace and to raise their children in good environment. But unfortunately, this is not available because usually people ask me what it's like to live in Gaza, and my response, I never been in a prison, but I live in one when I was in Gaza. So basically, they didn't have the freedom to travel in and out. And the only time usually they can leave Gaza, it's in Easter or in Christmas. They get the permission to leave for a few weeks. But even at that time, not all of them able to leave.
In terms of your book then, Pastor Mazad, which is called Pastor from Gaza, what do you hope the people will get from the book? What can they expect from it?
You know, I'd like people to know they have brothers and sisters in Gaza, because usually people didn't know that there's a Christian community in Gaza. I share with them the challenges we face as a Christian, and also I give Christian, I believe it's a balanced Christian perspective about the conflict, Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I share about the persecution we went through and the lessons we learned in the most difficult time of our life. And we, as the body of Christ, belong to one family, and we can learn from each other and enrich the life of one another. So I hope and pray many brothers and sisters will have the chance to get it and to read it. Will be a great encouragement for them.
Well, Pastor Mazad, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning. That was Pastor Hannah Mazad there, author of Pastor from Gaza. And that book, Pastor from Gaza, is available from Amazon in paperback and, of course, on Kindle. You might know it, but it's very important that you are aware of it, that there's a consultation process currently ongoing through the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. And this consultation is in relation to relationships and sexuality education. And I think it's really important that parents listening and perhaps educators or just anybody with an interest in this area participates in this process, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for people to get in touch and make submissions. On the line to tell us a little bit more about how you can get involved with the process, we have Kate Liffey, who's the National Director for Catechetics at the Irish Episcopal Conference. Kate, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy. Happy New Year.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about this consultation process. What's it all about?
So in April 2018, the then Minister for Education and Skills, Richard Bruton, asked the NCCA to undertake a major review of RSE in schools. And he felt that that review should include the curriculum itself, support materials, so programmes for the delivery of RSE, and interestingly, the delivery of the curriculum to students, and that would include CPD, continuous professional development for teachers. And I think that's an important one, that teachers are supported in whatever emerges out of this consultation. And I think it would be fair to say that most people welcome the review. Archbishop Eamon Martin, in an address last May in Galway, welcomed the review. A lot has changed since the mid-90s when RSE, as part of social, personal and health education, was put in place. So the issues that the NCCA are going to be reviewing include things like consent, what it means and its importance, developments in contraception, healthy positive sexual expression and relationships, very importantly the safe use of the internet, and social media, its effects, and also LGBTQI plus matters. And all of those issues, I suppose, have become more and more real and present in our society. And this review is an attempt, I suppose, to look at how our schools can address questions around these issues.
As you say, Kate, there's been a huge amount of change in such a short space of time. I think one of the positive changes, hopefully, but I think still parents find it difficult, is to talk to their children about sex and relationships. And obviously then a place where children learn about these things often is in school. Is it really just a consultation stage now, or is there kind of changes that are expected that might take place, or really, I guess, from a parent's perspective when they're thinking about the importance of this element of their children's education, what's at stake?
Well, I think it's a really good question, Wendy, and what's really important is that parents do engage with it. It is something that parents are often nervous about doing, but here's an opportunity maybe to relook at it and to say, well, what is exactly happening in schools? Because sometimes, and I say this as a parent, you have a sense of it, but it's really our responsibility to find out more information about what exactly our children are being taught at both primary and post-primary. So engaging in this review, I suppose, is part of that. The review information is online on ncca.ie, and there's a very simple survey that parents can do. I literally did it there about half an hour ago. It takes a minute. And an important question that the survey asks is around values. And that's really, really important. So this is an opportunity for parents to literally say, what is it that they value? What is it important? What is important for them when they're having conversations, or when the school has conversations with their children about relationships and sexuality education? So that's really, really important, that our engagement as parents is values driven, as opposed to maybe driven by fear, or driven by a nervousness, or driven even by embarrassment, but that it's values driven. We're trying to share something that we value with our children, and we're asking the schools who act in our place in this area while our children are in school to do the same, to share our values and the values that we hold dear with our children.
And it's great that it's a simple survey online, Kate, because I think sometimes when people hear, you know, submissions and consultation, they kind of vomit. There's a bit of fear surrounding it.
Yes.
And as you say, you just kind of went online and did it from a parent's perspective. And it's really just important to take the time out to do it. Much of the discussion around this in relation to relationships and sexuality education, certainly from from the media's perspective anyway, seems to be kind of moving any sort of faith-based ethos out of it. And, well, it's described as a neutral point of view, but I guess I would argue that a secular approach is also a belief system in and of itself. Do you think there could be a danger here of this huge shift in such a short space of time?
I agree. I mean, there's no such thing, and I think everyone would accept this, there's no such thing as a values-neutral education, and that's just fact. There isn't. So we have to ask ourselves then, well, what values are underpinning education in our schools? It's kind of interesting, as I was reflecting on this, I was thinking back to a few years ago, and my three-year-old and my two-year-old at the time were in the car, and my three-year-old turned to me and sighed very deeply and said to me, maybe she was thinking about her little sister's behaviour in the morning, which was a bit robust. She said to me, "Mammy, I think it's time we started to teach Maeve right from wrong." And for me, there's something in that. You know, as parents, we want to teach our children what's right and what's wrong. And this is something that is sometimes called conservative. And I suppose that's an underlying concern I have, is that whole swathes of Irish parents' views might not be taken seriously because they're labelled as conservative. And for me, it's not about being conservative or liberal. It's about what do we want for our children and what's best for our children. And, you know, as a parent, I'm naturally protective of my children, and I don't make any apology for that. That's my job. So I prefer that word protective to the word conservative. But there is a concern, I think, that's frequently out there that, you know, in this new Ireland, that people who have a certain view on relationships and sexuality, they're labelled conservative, and as a result of that, maybe don't feel as free to actually engage in the space as they should. But it's really, really, it's vitally important that we do engage with it. And ultimately, you know, we're not conservative just for the sake of it, or we're not protective just for the sake of it. We want to help our children to be able to think for themselves, to be free to make good decisions, to do what is right for them, according to, in my case, as a person of faith, according to what our faith teaches. And to know that there is such a thing as right from wrong, and that's really, really important. And I think the concern I'd have, and maybe others would have, is that the values that are important to me as a parent, the values that I think are worth conserving, need to be part of the conversation. And if they're not, well, then it's going to be a very one-sided debate, and it's going to not be a very, very particular, not going to be a particularly helpful one. So I suppose I would encourage people who, with a whole variety of opinions, to get involved and not to absent themselves from the debate for fear of being labelled. Probably the worst thing you can be labelled in Ireland at the moment is a conservative, or the second worst thing is a conservative person of faith. So you just need to be really, really, we just need to get stuck in and to give our views on these matters, because they are very important to us.
It's interesting that you should say that, because presumably the only way, or one of the main ways to rail against that improper and worrying kind of labelling of people based on their faith or their particular opinions is for people to stand up, let their voices be heard. I suppose from a faith-based perspective, would you be concerned, Kate, that there perhaps might be in the future, you know, a conflict with the characteristic spirit of faith-based schools with the road that sexuality and relationship education could go down?
Well, the two Archbishop Martins, Archbishop Eamon Martin and Archbishop Diarmaid Martin, they have different but very helpful inputs on this. Archbishop Diarmaid Martin, a number of years ago, stressed the importance that of, I suppose, ideology not dominating the debates we're having on education. He suggested that, you know, we need to move forward and form new bonds and partnerships to ensure that we have, in a sense, a common vision and not an antagonistic one, and a common vision that places the needs of children at its centre. And that's really important. So when I'm, as a parent, and in fact as a teacher, I always ask, well, where are the children in this? And Pope Francis in Amoris Laetitia is really keen on this. Where are the children? Not physically, but where are they emotionally? Where are they spiritually? Where are they in their development? So if we put children at the centre, I think we'll all come to a common space, and it doesn't need to be antagonistic. And the other Archbishop Martin, Archbishop Eamon Martin, I mentioned an address he gave in Galway last May. This is a really significant address, and I'd encourage people to go online to irishbishops.ie to read it. He was really clear that we have nothing to fear in this kind of debate. We have something very rich to offer, a very rich vision of marriage, a very rich vision of human sexuality. And it's about sharing that vision with our children, but it's also about bringing that vision into public discourse and saying, look, this is what we believe. Others will have different views, perhaps, but this is what we believe, and let's find common ground. And I suppose for me as a parent who's choosing to send my child to a Catholic school, it's really important for me to have a sense that that Catholic school is providing a space for that, for my child to be treated with great compassion and with great care, but also to receive the richness of what the Church teaches in the area of relationships and sexuality education. I think Archbishop Eamon Martin, in his address, you know, he responded to the second stage debate in the Dáil on the provision of objective sex education bill 2018, and he was very, I suppose, disappointed that the Church's approach was described by some as backward or distorted or non-factual and even biologically incorrect. This is very difficult to hear, and it's very difficult as a parent to hear that that's what people think about what the Church teaches in terms of relationships and sexuality education. So we need to get out there and counter some of that very negative stuff and say, look, what the Church teaches is actually, you know, it is fact-based, it is biologically correct, it is true, and there's a great truth to it, and we shouldn't be afraid to do that.
Kate Liffey, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Kate Liffey, the National Director for Catechetics, and she was talking about a review that's currently happening at the moment about relationships and sexuality education. It's very, very easy to do it, to participate as a parent or indeed as a teacher. All you have to do is go to ncca.ie, and on the homepage you'll see a tab that says consultations, and you'll see very clearly there the relationships and sexuality education consultation. It is a questionnaire that is only 13 questions long. I'd say it would take you 5 to 10 minutes to do. I think it's very, very important. Submissions have actually been taking place since June, but the closing date for submissions is the end of this month. So if you haven't done it now, and this is an area that concerns you as a parent, now is the time to do it. There's no point in talking about it after the fact. So make sure you go to ncca.ie. Well, there's never a quiet moment in US politics, that's for sure. There's been a partial US government shutdown in its third week, and President Trump declaring a potential national emergency over the construction of the US-Mexico border wall. Of course, that was a soundbite that we heard a lot about during his presidential campaign. We've also got Nancy Pelosi reclaiming Speaker of the House. So what is it going to be like for her this year? And what is the general political outlook for US politics in 2019? If you could predict it at all, going to look like. On the line, we have a law lecturer at NUI Galway and American political analyst Larry Donnelly. Morning, Larry. How are you?
Morning, Wendy. I see I got the easy job today.
Yeah, well, as always, when we're talking about what's happening in your lovely homeland. So first of all, Larry, tell us a little bit about this partial shutdown of the US government. What has led to it in the first place?
Well, I mean, the American federal government shutdowns are actually not uncommon. And a lot of people ask me, and I don't have a good answer for them, a lot of people ask me, why is this, how does this happen? Why can't you just keep going and keep going through it, especially when it impacts potentially on so many people's lives and livelihoods and of their families? However, the rather labyrinthine mechanics and workings of the United States federal government do, I suppose, in some sense, facilitate this. So effectively, when there isn't a congressional authorization to pay the bills, as it were, the funding just dries up. There isn't the money there because it isn't released by the Congress. This has happened because the president is insisting in $6 billion, roughly, for the building of his wall along the southern border of the United States. Democrats are unwilling to go along with this request. And one of the things about this that's strange, I don't really understand why the president is putting so many apples in this basket and at lots of levels, but one key thing is the reality is in the midterm elections, the Democrats retook the House of Representatives. They have a solid majority there. The president just doesn't have the numbers to get away with this, and I just don't think the Democratic Party are going to back down. And I think the key group to watch are Republicans, and particularly Republicans up for re-election in 2 years in states that aren't necessarily red states. They're going to start wavering about this because they know the American people don't really like government shutdowns, and my strong suspicion is that they're going to hold the president responsible for it.
And that's usually what will happen in the case of these shutdowns, right, Larry, where there is, you know, politics going on in the background, trying to win over different members of the House, all that sort of stuff. But it doesn't seem there's many people that can be won over on this.
No, it doesn't. I think Democrats are going to really, I suppose, stay steadfast on this. And this is another issue for Nancy Pelosi. I mean, the reality is a lot of pretty radical left-wing people were elected in the midterm elections. They are going to want her to hold fast to the fire on this. And indeed, one of the things that some of them want to do is start impeachment proceedings right now, which I think would be disastrous potentially for the Democratic Party because they just don't have enough to go on. But she's going to have to balance those cries from the left of her party along with, I suppose, more moderate people. And she also will be well aware of the American people and the fact that 2 years the people will be watching the Democratic Party to see how it pivots in this time. So she's got a real difficult balancing act. And this is one of the issues I think that she's going to have to need to do that, to execute that balancing act, because, you know, again, she's going to have to please those people who are going to say, do not cave in to the president on this one bit.
There is the balancing act that Nancy Pelosi has to play with her colleagues and others. But what about just the American people in general? Is there really a desire for this wall? Do they actually want it?
Well, the polling data shows that 38% of the American people are in favor of the wall, which is just about the number of Trump's base. It's, or Trump's base is around 40 to 42% of the electorate. These are people who are going to be with him no matter what. So in response to your question, the clear majority of the American people do not want this. And indeed, even some of the people who support the president on this issue, all of the academic work suggests that these people don't vote at the end of the day on immigration. They might be sympathetic to what the president says, but they, like most people, ultimately vote on what's in their pockets. And this is what's so puzzling to me, is given the economy performing very well in the United States, I don't know why the president is retrenching on the immigration issue when he should be talking about the economy.
And that's what you think, Larry, he should be focusing his attention on?
Yeah, I do. I think we know there were some dips in the stock market towards the end of the year. I think if he's concerned about anything, he should be concerned about that, because the key demographic in the United States at the moment is not the Trump core, who we spend all sorts of time talking about. It's actually the soft Trump voters who voted for him because they wanted to give the system a kick. They might necessarily have liked Hillary Clinton. They wanted to change things in Washington, D.C. They're with him still. Some of them are with him still because of the economy. What he should focus in on is how those people are faring economically, and if he has a worry, it should be about that dip in the stock market. If there's anything that for him is a political emergency, it's any fall in the stock market, because these people who supported him and still might be inclined to vote for him for re-election, they might necessarily like him or like everything about him, but they like what he's done for their stock portfolios.
One of the things that Nancy Pelosi would be remembered for in terms of her last tenure as Speaker is legislating. And this, you could argue, is a distraction from her also trying to do her job.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that there are issues. I think Nancy Pelosi actually and the president, they could work together on one issue in particular, and that's infrastructure. And I think I've said this to you before, Wendy, but anybody who's been to the United States recently will know that the country's infrastructure is badly ailing, the roads, the bridges, the rail network, et cetera, et cetera. There needs to be investment in that. And this is something the president broke with his party on in the sense that he wants to spend a lot of money to rebuild American infrastructure. That's an issue where he could work together with the Democrats on, and indeed that would help his political standing and in a lot of the industrial heartland, indeed the very states that put him over the top in the election. That's the kind of thing that I suspect Nancy Pelosi and the president would like to work on. I'm sure she's extremely frustrated that all of the energy and everything is being put on a so-called crisis at the border, when there is just no objective evidence to indicate that the crisis at the border is any worse in January 2019 than it was in 2018 or 2017 or 2016.
One of the things that might interest Irish citizens at the moment is a discussion that's ongoing in relation to a different type of visa. I think it's a visa that's afforded specifically to Australians. What do we know about this?
Yeah, this was passed by the House of Representatives. It was essentially an initiative that Australia has a bilateral agreement with the United States where thousands of visas allowing their citizens to work and live in the United States on a permanent basis, roughly, broadly speaking. Australians don't take up those visas, the full allocation of visas that there are. There was an agreement that Ireland would get the remainder of those visas, which would be several thousand each year. President Trump is on board with this. The former Speaker, Paul Ryan, was on board with this. The House of Representatives passed it. But again, because of the bizarre kind of functioning of the American Congress, it required full 100% agreement in the United States Senate to get across the line. And there was one senator, Tom Cotton from Arkansas, who opposed this measure for reasons that, quite frankly, are beyond me. I just don't understand why he did that. But it was, again, it was a really crushing blow for a lot of advocates for Irish immigration to the United States to have to absorb. I think they're going to go back to the well on this. I think they're going to push hard. I think they're going to try to convince Senator Cotton. But again, if you care, like I do, so deeply about the relationship between our two countries, it's very sad to say, Wendy, but there just aren't people immigrating to the United States from Ireland in any significant numbers whatsoever. And when that declines, ultimately, at the end of the day, some of the ties that bond our two countries so closely together, indeed, some of the reasons why my grandparents were able to go to the United States, this is going to fray. The ties are going to fray. So this is a deeply concerning matter.
It's an interesting way of thinking about it as well, as trying to keep up those ties that we so often celebrate, and probably the reason that we are so interested in U.S. politics. And not only that, you know, that some commentators would be saying, what happens politically in 2019 in the States will have an impact on Ireland. What are your predictions for 2019, and do you think it's going to impact us over here?
Yeah, it's a very good and very difficult question. On one thing, and I know Dan O'Brien was writing in the Sunday Independent on this over the weekend, despite some of the worries to the contrary, I don't think there's going to be any drying up of foreign direct investment. I don't think any of the companies that are here, and they're here for all sorts of very good reasons, I don't think they're going to be going back to the United States despite some of the rhetoric that we hear from this president. So I think on that front, I think that Ireland is relatively secure. When it comes to the immigration issue, obviously that's one that I think we'll be watching very, very carefully. Unfortunately, I don't expect that there will be any progress for the undocumented. I don't think that that's going to happen in the current climate. And I just read an item indicating, indeed, that more than the number of Irish people deported from the U.S. Over the past year doubled. So that's obviously a worrying development. In terms of the visa issue we just spoke about, I would be hopeful that one senator might change his mind on this front, and I think that the efforts of the Irish government and indeed Irish American activists on the ground, I think that they might bear fruit. So fingers crossed on that one. But when it comes to American politics in 2019, we're only 1 year off a presidential election. So once this shutdown business, and I do expect there will be some kind of fudge, that there will be a deal done before too much longer. Once that settles down, all of the attention is going to turn to the presidential election. And I think it's going to be fascinating to watch the Democratic primary process, because you're going to have potentially 25 candidates in the race looking to take on Donald Trump. And one prediction I'll make, and I'm wrong more often than I'm right, unfortunately, but if I was to identify where there is space in a very crowded field like that, just like the Republican primary in 2016, where there is space, in my view, is in the middle. Most of those candidates are going to be running hard to the left. If one candidate can distinguish him or herself, it's by being in the middle. And indeed, I think it's going to take somebody in the middle to beat Donald Trump, because the road to the White House leads through the heartland. It doesn't lead through the coast, where Democrats are going to win convincingly. Somebody who can appeal to middle America.
And perhaps that is exactly what America needs, trying to steer away from this kind of real polarization that we've seen happening in the last number of years. Larry Donnelly, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. Larry Donnelly is a law lecturer at NUI Galway, and indeed you'll see him writing often in the journal.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.